Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the new CEO of GM testifies before Congress about her predecessor's decision to keep cars on the road, which they knew were defective and which killed at least 13 people. Experts say GM will pay a huge fine, but should those responsible go to jail? Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us to break down Obamacare sign-up numbers and talk of a Western Mass hospital closing with virtually no notice. Then Globe editor Brian McGorry on two firefighter deaths, the Remy aftermath, and a gubernatorial candidate's kidney stone.
Jared Bowen on the latest films, movies, and the latest update on the controversial sleepwalker sculpture at Wellesley College. Plus, new apps to save you from running into people you never want to see again. Jim Browdy has his. That's all coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So when it comes to giving money to political campaigns, as we know, corporations are people. But when it comes to manslaughter, corporations reject the rules that come with being human. For years, as you know, the executives at General Motors knew that their cars had a defective ignition switch, a manufacturing flaw that proved to be fatal in at least 13 cases. Last month, Toyota had to pay $1.2 billion to settle a criminal probe into their own safety issues, and many think it's a deal that could serve as a template for how authorities approach GM. If that proves to be the case, what does it say about our values, about our judicial system, and about corporate accountability if no one at GM or Toyota has to pay the figurative price by going to jail? 877-301-8970. The question is quite simple today. Is a large fine, an historic fine in the case of Toyota, is it enough? Or do the men and women responsible for knowingly allowing cars to go out that ended up causing the deaths of at least 13 people in the case of GM, 5 people in the case of Toyota, is a fine, not even paid out of the pockets of these people, enough? 877-301-8970. If you missed Mary Barra, she's the new CEO, you know, of General Motors, the first woman CEO of a car company. Yesterday, she apologizes in front of the House Energy and Commerce Committee.
Whatever mistakes were made in the past, we will not shirk from our responsibilities now or in the future. Today's GM will do the right thing. That begins with my sincere apologies to everyone who has been affected by this recall, especially the families and friends who lost their lives or were injured. I am deeply sorry.
Today she's testifying in front of a Senate committee, but in between, after Barra testifies in front of this House committee, our own United States Senator Ed Markey makes a really important point at a press conference with the family of some of the victims.
$2. That's right, $2. That's how little this ignition switch could have cost to repair.
I have to say, this is one of these things where my head is going to pop off. $2. And by the way, when the Toyota deal was made, all of the experts in this field say this is the template. Essentially a huge fine. Toyota, which is rare in settlements, admitted that they had lied to the public about this thing, but no criminal penalties. And the assumption is, based upon all the expertise, especially with the new CEO, Marjorie, that's what's going to happen to GM. A huge fine. 13 people are dead. And they did appoint, to her credit, she picked Ken Feinberg. Everybody knows he was the guy that administered the One Fund Boston, the 9/11 compensation fund, to compensate the families. But it appears to me the executives are getting all scot-free.
Well, also, she's on the hot seat, and she wasn't even the executive that was there at the time,
right,
which is really distressing. So you don't get to ask the person that was numero uno at the time these decisions were made what exactly happened. But there's another troubling aspect to this that we should, before we get to the calls, we should mention. By the way, our number is 877-301-8970. There was this memo released on Sunday by a House subcommittee that talked about the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that's supposed to be looking out, obviously, for everybody's safety on the roads. And according to this new memo, both GM and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration ignored dismissed, I'm reading right from the New York Times, ignored or dismissed warnings for more than a decade about this faulty ignition switch that, you know, could be turned off. When it turned off, by the way, you couldn't put on the brakes. You couldn't steer the car. The engine with no warning just turned off.
And the airbags won't come out.
Yes. And it happened to people that were on the highway driving down the road at 60 or 65 miles an hour. Or they were, in one case, they were sitting on railroad tracks and the cars shut down. So it's very distressing that the government agency that's supposed to be looking out for this did almost nothing about this, and especially since back in the 1990s, the same government agency failed to detect the defects in those. Remember the rollovers with the Ford Explorers and the Firestone tires? So supposedly they were on the up and up, and apparently they weren't on the up and up. And when one official did want to have an investigation in 2007, apparently he was overruled by the Bush administration.
Now, for those who are listening, we're going to get to your calls in a couple of minutes and say, well, if they pay a huge fine, that's enough. Let me bring it down to the barbershop level, or actually, let me bring it down to the bakery level. There's a great opinion column in the Dallas News by this guy, Todd Roberson. Let me just read you the first couple of paragraphs. So a group of pastry chefs are in a kitchen and decide to bake a bunch of cakes. The cakes they produce are good, so they decide to make hundreds of them. One of the chefs thinks he's reaching for baking powder, but actually grabs rat poison and puts it in the mixture. Another chef sees him do it and says, you could really hurt or even kill people by doing that. Have you done that before? The other chef shrugs and says he might have. They discuss the matter with other chefs. The cakes look so nice, and they're selling really well, and only a few people have complained, and the cake seems to sell fine with rat poison in it, and really only a couple of customers have died. They could quickly remove all the cakes and warn the public of the danger, but instead they decide that it's okay for a little rat poison to go out in the cakes. In fact, they decide mass production of cakes with rat poison is a good idea. Now, do we all not agree that if that happened, every single one of those chefs would be tried for either murder or manslaughter or something? Why is it that huge corporations, which knowingly, this is not a situation where they argue, I feel horrible, we didn't detect the flaws. They knew about the flaws. They didn't want to do a recall. The fix, as Ed Markey said, would have cost $2 per car. And they decided, because obviously there was a whole tumult about the auto industry in the middle of this thing, not to do a major recall. And as a result, 13 families have lost somebody they love. And I'm not, even if Ken Feinberg, who is a genius and a compassionate genius, works out something with GM to compensate the families as adequately as one can when someone has lost, again, someone they love, why are the people who made these decisions knowingly not going to jail like any other mere mortal would?
And you know what's so weird when you think about the GM situation is we bailed them out. You know, so.
Oh, it gets worse. I'm glad you said that. Are you aware of the fact, and I assume the new CEO is not going to use this, do you know that because of the law around their bankruptcy passed by Congress, that any death that happened prior to 2009, the bankruptcy period, they are immune from lawsuit? So if any one of these 13, not if, whichever one of these 13 deaths happened before, I think it was 2009, if GM wanted to, they're protected by federal legislation. It's pretty clear this Barra is not going to allow that to happen. 877-301-8970. What do you think is appropriate punishment for corporations and their leaders in situations like this?
By the way, we have a local angle here. Marie Stanislao, a colleague of mine at the Boston Herald, interviewed a former Boston College former NFL player who's now a Boston College football coach. His 19-year-old sister, Sarah Trotwine, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, was driving one of these 2005 Chevrolet Cobalts when she was killed. He's maybe nicer or maybe less vengeful. I don't know what the right word is, but he wants them to be fired. He doesn't want them to go to prison. But I'm with you, Jim. I think that prison is a good idea.
And by the way, here is a little sound from Phil Trautwein himself.
It's hard, you know, because we thought we had an answer, and we were coping with the fact that she died peacefully and while she was sleeping at the wheel. And now, for us as a family, we have to think about what was her last thoughts. Was she fighting for her life? Was she trying to steer, you know, her straight? Was she trying to get out of the car? And for us, that's something that we'll never know, and that's something that GM, in a way, took away from us.
877-301-8970. What's the appropriate sanction here? And is it enough, as in the case of Toyota, where there are five deaths and an admission of deceiving the public, is it enough that they pay a huge fine, which, again, does not come out of the pockets of the responsible people? It's a post-tax charge to the corporation itself. Let's start in Plymouth, where Jeff is on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, great show as always.
Thank you.
Topic. Just very quickly first, I hope this does not become a pin the tail on this. 51 employees, they have over 200 million cars on the, I watched the testimony on the road, and they get just from consumers alone 45,000 complaints a year. It's just too much work to few people. But more importantly, criminally negligent homicide. I don't know if anyone in this country has ever gone to jail on that, but they need to make a case to send a message so that it causes some second guessing as far as if on the parts of corporations if their decisions are actually justifiable.
You know, by the way, I'm so glad you said what you said, Jeff. I'll let you continue in a second. That's a really important point because any corporate leader knows the likelihood of him or her having personal liability is virtually nil. Then they do a risk-benefit analysis, and they say, let's see, we may lose some lives along the way, and we may ultimately have a recall and may have to pay a fine. Is that cheaper than having to recall 2.5 million cars or whatever they ended up doing? And obviously, in most of these cases, they decided it is cheaper. They wouldn't be making that decision if they knew they were going to end up in jail should their misdeeds be discovered. So that's a great point, Jeff.
Exactly. And we haven't changed. We go back. That's exactly what you're just talking about, Jim. Cost-benefit analysis was done on exploding gas tanks on the Ford Pinto.
Pinto, so that's right.
And it changed. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Jeff. By the way, Michael Moore takes a position a little more extreme than mine and Marjorie's, but nevertheless, he writes in the Huffington Post, I'm opposed to this is the filmmaker, obviously, who is his first famous movie, Roger and Me, about Flint, Michigan.
It was pretty good.
And by the way, she's from, Mary Barra is from Flint, Michigan, which is sort of interesting. I'm opposed to the death penalty, he writes, but to every rule, there's usually an exception. In this case, I hope the criminals at General Motors will be arrested and made to pay for their premeditated decision to take human lives for a lousy $10. That's what he calculates is the cost. Ed Markey says $2, $10, whatever it is, it's pocket change. It's a cup of coffee or maybe two or three.
877-301-8970. What do you think should happen to the responsible people at General Motors? And frankly, the responsible people at the National Transportation Highway Safety Board, whatever you call it. What's the correct name?
That's close
National
enough.
Highway
that's right.
Traffic Safety Administration. Okay. Let's go to John and Gardner. Hi, John.
Hello, John.
Hello, my friends, Jim and Marjorie. How are you?
We're
great.
Good. Nice to hear from you.
Marjorie, I don't want to give Jim too much of a boost to his ego, but I got to admit, I never had thought of it that way about the corporations can, or individuals when they're donating, but they're not when they're under situations like this. That's a good point, Jim.
Well, in the spirit of full disclosure, the point, I read it was made by our colleague and producer, Chelsea Mers, but I'll pass along your praise, John. Thanks.
Oh, I appreciate that, Jim. But, this poor Mary, I don't know if it's poor Mary Barra, but she's out there. Why? And especially since we know that 90% of these dog and pony Senate and House hearings are for the politicians' benefits, why can't they haul in the previous CEO, put him under oath, and have him track down who was in the chain of command that made these decisions?
Well, those are all good questions.
I wondered the same thing, and I have not been able to discover the answer to that, John. But you're exactly. Why is she having to take the heat when she wasn't there when these things happened?
Well, particularly since in her testimony, I didn't hear the testimony in front of the Senate today, but her testimony yesterday, John, in front of the House, basically said, I don't know why they made these decisions. We're going to get to the bottom of it. Well, rather than having the CEO investigate her own company, why doesn't Congress investigate her company? And as you say, have the major decision makers in who were there at the time that they decided to go the way they went. John, thank you as always for your call. 877-301-8970. The point, if you just tuned in, that John was praising, that was not mine originally, was that when it comes to campaign finance issues and elections, corporations are people, as we learned in the last campaign. But when it comes to major crimes, corporate leaders are not people. The corporation itself, in rare cases, is required to pay a fine. In the case of Toyota, it was a $1.2 billion fine. Here's Eric Holder. And by the way, this was celebrated. He's the attorney general. He's talking about the $1.2 billion settlement announced for Toyota owners after it was found that Toyota covered up problems with that acceleration. And by the way, one of the reasons why we're able to say that we believe that the Toyota deal will be a template for GM is not just what experts say. I don't know, Marjorie, if you heard excerpts from the press conference when Holder spoke, and we'll play his sound in a minute. One of the assistants, I think from the New York District, I'm not sure wherever it was initiated, spoke and inadvertently, in the ultimate Freudian slip, said this settlement with General Motors, I mean Toyota, which led some to believe that they're working on the same deal. Here's Holder a week or so ago.
Put simply, Toyota's conduct was shameful. It showed a blatant disregard for systems and laws designed to look after the safety of consumers. By the company's own admissions, it protected its brand ahead of its own customers. This constitutes a clear and reprehensible abuse of the public trust.
And a crime, Attorney General Holder. And by the way, he is right. It's a rare circumstance. I read it this morning. The Toyota admitted to the Department of Justice's criminal charges, and the statement was not equivocal. It was one of these things where they admitted they deceived the public about the acceleration thing and what they knew, which is groundbreaking, as is the size of the fine. But the men, and I assume women, but probably men, are walking away scot-free.
And you know what just is really discouraging about this whole thing on a macro level? It just undermines, it underscores rather, again, how arbitrary our system of justice is. You know, as we've said a million times, who went to jail on Wall Street? Who are these mortgage scammers?
Virtually nobody.
Went to jail on Wall Street. Bernie Madoff's in jail. He's about the, you know, he wasn't a...
Well, but that's for even a different thing.
His Ponzi scheme thing. He's in jail. We know Sal DeMacy's in jail. But, you know, basically, who goes to jail? Well, drug dealers go to jail.
But all of those
black and they live on the inside.
Would all of those pastry chefs have gone to jail in the example that I read from Dallas?
I don't know.
Of course they would.
Well, maybe. Jared Remy didn't go to jail, did he? And he had a 17-year career of beating up women. So
I don't think the pastry chefs have their father broadcasting Red Sox games.
But, I mean, the point is, what's the famous line about the only justice that goes on?
I know,
on
we always get it right.
Courthouses,
in
the halls or something like that. And it's really, it's just very discouraging. Let's go to Tom in Sharon. Hi, Tom.
Hi there.
Hi.
I don't know that all that much about the GM case, but I know that in a corporation that large, the lines of responsibility and culpability are kind of hard to draw out. But I wanted to use a case that's a little closer to home, that's sort of more in line with the pastry chef thing in the drug compounding firm in Massachusetts, where hundreds of people were infected and died from meningitis.
Yep.
And I've wondered why no one is in jail for that.
I think you are right that no one is in jail, and it's a pretty good question. I have to say, I'm not 100% sure what the outcome was, and I'm not sure if criminal charges were contemplated or brought, but we're going to check it out for you right now, and we'll try to answer the question before we finish in the next couple of minutes. That's a very good case.
So we do know Annie Duquin is in jail, and she's the one that was cooking the books in terms of people that were arrested for alleged drug dealing, and they may have wound up being drug dealers, but they get out of jail because of her nefarious messing with the drugs.
You know what, Tom, are you still there or are you going? Tom's gone. What I'm not sure of, but we'll check. One of our colleagues will check in a second. I'm not sure. Did the people in the compounding firm, did they know and choose? Was it sloppiness? Was it misfeasance or was it malfeasance? I don't recall.
I didn't think
we'll
it was intentional, but I could be wrong.
We'll check in a couple of seconds.
Let's go to Bob from Gloucester. What should happen to the people from GM and the people from the government agency supposed to be watching out for GM?
Hey, Bob.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. This is a serious problem, of course, and I'm an engineer who has worked with automobile companies in the past. But I did want to remind the public of a situation that occurred during the Reagan administration when Ronald Reagan decided that in order to promote car sales at a time when they were slow, he would have the government delay the announcement of all recalls for a year. And I happen to have owned a car that had the problem, and I discovered the problem on my own and junked the car about 2 weeks before I got the notice that it had been declared a safety hazard a year before.
Mm. Wow.
And in this case, the funny thing was that it cost me about $2,500 because the government's fix for the thing was that they were supposed to refund the purchase price of the car. And it was a defect that resulted in the frame cracking in two.
Well, the only good news out of that, Bob, is you're living to talk about it, unlike at least 13 GM owners and at least five Toyota owners. Thanks for the story, Bob. We appreciate it.
So I guess this has been going on forever, with Reagan in the 80s, with the Ford Explorer in the 90s, and now with these GM cars in the 2000s.
Well, and
that's
also
very comforting.
And by the way, as I said, one of the reasons why this is not a defense, this is in part a pathetic explanation, is because GM was going through as many problems as they were. At the time, it's one of the reasons they decided not to do a recall. But what I said before to the first caller, this is all about bottom lines. It's a calculation. Are we going to get, what's the worst that's going to happen to us? Well, maybe a fine and maybe a large fine. But is that something that is cheaper than doing the fix? And by the way, you may say it's not cheaper if the cost is, as Michael Moore says, $10 a car, or as Ed Markey, Senator Ed Markey says, $2 a car. It's not just about the dollar cost. It's about the reputation of the company. And I assume their hope was they could slide through this. And obviously, at the end of the day, they didn't. But the question is, what's the ultimate price left?
You know, Paul from Milton reminds me I should have gone back even further than the 80s with Reagan. Well, he says, look back to the early 1960s when GM put out the Corvair rear engine that had a history of flipping over. And Ralph Nader published Unsafe at Any Speed. And he emails that Ernie Kovacs was killed when his Corvair flipped over on Hollywood Street.
True. Great comedian.
I did not know that. Mark he's very upset about this. He thinks that these corporate criminals should be hanged and then dragged through the streets. I don't know if I'd go that far.
And by the way, part of the problem in some settings is the law. It's not just those who are putting the law in place. Martha Coakley, when she made the attorney general, when she made the huge settlement with Bechtel and other big dig companies, I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million. And a few days later, she was on our show, and we got into a little debate about why didn't you go after the leaders? And the law, in her defense, the law in Massachusetts is such that it is virtually impossible to penetrate a corporation and get to the leaders. In this case, it'd probably be easier because they're admitting that they did something wrong and that they deceived people. And secondly, in Massachusetts, at least at the time of that settlement, the fine, I think for manslaughter or something like that, corporation was a maximum of $1,000.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And I think they upped that a little. But the bottom line was, you know, is it better to get $500 million and not have a criminal finding, or getting a criminal finding and have paying nickels and dimes?
We talked about outrageous corporate salaries yesterday with Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School, how the ratio is like 350-something now to 1 in terms of what the leader of corporations make versus what the worker makes. So maybe if you're making 100 grand a year or 50 grand a year, part of your deal can be that the buck does stop with you when things go bad in your corporation. You have to pay that money out of your $50 million or your $100 million salary, and then you might be more careful.
By the way, getting back to the call a couple of minutes ago, the New England Compounding Center, they filed for bankruptcy protection in 2012. One of our colleagues just did the research. There have been roughly 400 compensation lawsuits filed against them, but as of the moment, it doesn't look like anybody has gone to jail or will be going to jail.
And I just want to tell a quick story about that. I remember when that story broke, interviewing the relative of a woman who was only in her 50s and barely 50 and just had like lower back problems like millions of people have. I mean, she's perfectly healthy, playing sports, taking care of her children and all that. So she walks in one day and gets one of these shots and she's dead. I mean, it was just unbelievable. Unbelievable. Everybody's got lower back problems or back problems. I mean, they're so common. And dead. That was it. Gone.
Let's squeeze in one or two more if we can. Matt, you're in Kingsborough. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm just picking up my son from a half day of school, so you'll hear some background noise.
That's okay.
Listen, we're worker bees. We're a source of tax revenue, and a few of us died. No big deal to the government. If you listen to these conversations all day long, you'll have a different story each and every minute. I called because my friend of mine, speaking of ignition issues, was on a May day taking his motorcycle out on that first 60-degree day. And in the distance in Malden, there was a crime going on where a young man was trying to break into a car at a grocery store. An off-duty fireman saw him do it, chased him. He held the guy off while he was breaking into a second car, and then within 8 seconds had the car window smashed and the screwdriver in the ignition, which I think they call the Chicago Punch.
Mm-hmm.
It's a maneuver that the auto industry has known about for years, has never fixed, and you jam the screwdriver into the ignition and start it somehow. Now, he stole the car, went over the curb, and went through a red light and hit my buddy, putting him into a coma and taking off, severing his left leg.
Oh, my God.
And my buddy didn't have a chance. He tried to go against, I believe it was GM, but they just smothered the case. Smothered him. But
so
they thought about this.
I'm sorry, what was the ultimate outcome, meaning that they threw some small change at him, or he lost the whole thing?
He lost the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're going up...
88, I believe, but, oh, yeah, and it was a maneuver that apparently has been talked about before. Maybe your research can look it up, but it was called the... On the criminal side, it was called the Chicago Punch.
Matt, thank you. We got it. We will check in, and thank you for, well, it's a pretty horrible story. You know, I want to get back, before we leave this, to something. I mean, beyond the fact that at least the two of us think the Justice Department is not going as far as they should go, I want to underline the point that you made. It's not just GM in this case. The agency in charge of these issues, which had received complaints and knew about deaths, the federal agency, did absolutely nothing for years. So, you know, we're always looking for a public-private partnership. Well, the bad news is this is the worst kind of public-private partnership.
You know, we just got an email from Carl saying that they shouldn't be blaming the NHTSA, the government agency looking over traffic, because they had massive budget cuts. And I guess you could, you know, if people are overwhelmed. But, I mean, when you're getting, you know, two complaints a month about dangerous shutdowns that go on over years. I mean, if you don't have enough money to do anything, call the Washington Post or call the New York Times or call somebody. I mean, and just say, we can't look into this, but blow the whistle and,
you know,
hang up the phone.
You know, we played a couple of minutes ago, the former NFL player, now BC coach, Troutwine, was talking about his sister who died. You described it perfectly. I'm sure many people listening have had the experience, which didn't end badly, where your car dies, your car stalls. And if you have a car that was made after 19-something, it's a power steering car. You can't steer anymore.
Right.
You can brake, but it's really, really hard to brake. And if you get in an accident because you can't steer, the airbags don't come out. So it's not just, if people are saying, well, it's an ignition problem and it's serious, but
it's not that serious.
Essentially, you cannot operate your car.
Going down the highway, 60 miles an hour, this happens. No brakes, no steering, and no airbags. I mean, you are in serious trouble.
By the way, one of the things we are going to check into, and we will actually try to do this with Senator Markey's office in the next 24 hours and report back to you, is why, if the caller was right, and I believe the caller was right, why have the Barra's predecessors, who were around at the time these decisions were made, not subpoenaed?
I don't know.
Or at least urged to testify in front of Congress? We'll try to get an answer for that for you by tomorrow.
Okay, up next, we're going to talk to medical ethicist Art Kaplan, get his take on Obamacare enrollment numbers, the startling North Adams Hospital closing with only a couple of days' notice, and other medical news. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
As Russian troops remain near the eastern border of Ukraine, Russia's neighbors say the ghosts of Soviet days are still alive and well.
Once you have a madman in the head, it's uncontrolled power, which is the worst what can happen to any country in the world.
We'll hear views from the former Soviet bloc all this week on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Arts Emerson, The World on Stage, presenting Lebensraum, a live-action silent movie inspired by Buster Keaton. Mayhem and slapstick ensues when two inventors create a doll that has a mind of her own. Tickets at artsemerson.org. And Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting guitarists Sergio and Odair Assad and the Assad family in a Brazilian songbook, this Saturday at NEC's Jordan Hall. You can learn more at celebrityseries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The numbers are in, and the Obama administration is popping the champagne. Obamacare enrollment is 7.1 million strong. But are the numbers massaged, or is this a legitimate victory for the White House? And in 2014, how can a hospital close with virtually no notice and get away with it? Joining us to go over these and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. And since we last spoke with Art, the National Science Board has anointed him with their 2014 Public Service Award. High art and congratulations.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. My mother thanks you.
You know, that is great. All right, tell us about this, the Public Service Award. What are the criteria?
So this is given out by the National Science Board, National Science Foundation, for kind of acknowledging people who try to communicate about science, engineering, and medicine to the public. So listeners may remember the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould. He won that award. Actually, the science desk at NPR won that award one year.
Wow.
Alan Alda, I think, won it one year. So it's something I'm very, very happy to get because, as you all know, I think talking about these issues, even though I know I'm right and there's probably no need for anybody else to talk about them, engaging the public and having them, you know, appreciate and understand their choices, their options, deciding what they want to do, hopefully thinking about it a little bit by the kind of conversations that we have getting them thinking about it, is important. It's just a part of what I think people in science and engineering medicine should do. And I hope that people find all that stuff interesting.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm very impressed, and our listeners are very impressed. We are getting our information from a guy that is a real hotshot here at the at the top of his game with all these esteemed people. Congratulations again.
By the way, feel free to mention us at the ceremony. It's fine. You don't have to call to get our okay. It's
fine. I did. Yeah. I actually have. I gave it to the PR people. Undoubtedly see it. I mentioned
terrific.
This show in GBA.
Well, congratulations, Art.
So, Art, tell us about the Obamacare numbers. Jim just called them massaged. I don't know if that's
the right description
of the numbers in the healthcare thing. But in any case, you know, there's been allegations, as you know, that a lot of these people that are, a lot of these 7 million people are people that already had insurance. So what do you hear about the reality here?
You know, there are days when I wake up and I'm really glad I'm in a clear-cut, hard-nosed field like ethics, where we know what is what. When you get into the sciences, what does this figure of 7 million mean? It's completely obscure, completely difficult to understand. You know, better to go with values than facts on certain things. The problem with the number is that, in one sense, they hit a goal that they announced, and they should celebrate it, the 7 million plus enrollees, given the rough start of the enrollment process and website problems and all the rest of that. You know, hooray that they got these people jumping in and expanding Medicaid as well. What isn't known is a couple of other variables. One is, are these all sick people? Because if they are, if they don't have some healthy people, young healthy people in those numbers, it's going to be fiscally hard to maintain the program, and we don't know quite who they are yet. The other problem is that the people who signed up, people who already had insurance, they just got a better deal. So we didn't pick up the uninsured, which was the goal of the program. Did people just shift over from more expensive plans? Did employers dump people out knowing they could sign up here? So did we make a dent in the uninsured? Again, not clear from that number.
You know, our let's get back to the 18 to 34-year-old healthy sign-up issue. Preliminary reports maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago suggested that while the Obama administration's goal, I think was 38%, they were somewhere in the mid to low 20s. Assuming that that number holds and they don't, at least in the initial sign-up period, get to the level that they said they needed for it to be fiscally achievable, what's the consequence of that? Much more dramatic increase in premiums than was otherwise anticipated? Is that what happens?
That's exactly what happens. So in order to have affordable rates, the way insurance works in healthcare is the healthy have to support the sick. People with chronic illness are a minority of people. You may become one of those people someday, but when you're healthy and younger, you're literally carrying the costs of the older and sicker. If only older and sicker people are in there to cover them, you're going to have to raise your premiums, raise what you charge people. So it's an ethics issue. Should the young, in a way, subsidize the old? It's certainly a question we've answered in a program like Social Security with a resounding yes. Some of the critics of Obamacare would say, no, you know, everybody should pull their own weight, and I don't have to take care of you, and that's the that's kind of the moral fight behind some of the criticism of the whole effort.
But, you know, what I always thought was a flaw in that moral fight was Mitt Romney said this, you know, the freeloader angle, that if you are young and uninsured and you're saying you're not willing to pay for insurance because you are healthy, and then you get in a car accident or something terrible happens, you become a freeloader in essence.
Great point. And I think there are relatively few among the critics who would say, you know what, if you didn't sign up, and you don't have cash in your pocket when you fall off your motorcycle without a helmet in the name of liberty, you lie on the ground. Yeah. That is to say, they're going to drag them into that ER, and we're all going to pay for them. So to me, morally, the reality is healthcare isn't an option. It's not something that you can have like a beachfront house. It's a necessity, and everybody's going to use it at some point, and therefore I think it is kind of a duty of each one of us to have some minimal health insurance. You know, we do that for automobiles.
Yep.
I don't know why we wouldn't do it for healthcare.
Let's come back local, if we can, for a couple of minutes. In the far reaches of Western Massachusetts, there was a hospital named North Adams Regional Hospital. It closed last week, both the hospital and the emergency room, on Friday and Saturday, with apparently 3 days' notice. There's a debate in state amongst some of the major stakeholders as to whether or not state law requires more notice. Forget the law for a second. I don't know what the state is, and I think it is a dispute. I found this, even though they're in precarious financial situation, to be unconscionable, unethical, any unword one can come up with. What's the history of this kind of thing? I mean, by the way, and for, if you don't know Northwest Massachusetts.
Oh, I know North Adams. Tough times in that area for a long time.
Right, and for those who don't know, the nearest hospital is 20 miles away, and the guy who runs the ambulance service says it takes us minutes to bring somebody to the emergency room at North Adams Regional. It will take us over an hour to get someone to the emergency room in Pittsfield. But I'm sorry I interrupted you. So what's the deal on this?
So here's the deal. In a market, when you have for-profit healthcare, businesses unfortunately close on a dime. If you don't legislate and require that they give notice 30 days, 60 days, or make provision for alternatives, they do close. I've seen it happen in other parts of the country where the bankrupt, close for business sign went up literally almost overnight, like has happened here. Do I think it's ethical? No. I think you're not only putting people at risk who are in the hospital, who all of a sudden have to get moved out of the blue. As you said, Jim, they're now not serving a huge swath of the community that doesn't have any access to emergency care and other care in reasonable time. That's what destroys the ability of people to live in rural areas. You know, they just say, I can't stay here. There's no health care for me. So it's not just a question of health. It's a question of, are we ever going to be able to redevelop that part of Massachusetts? And I'm going to say without a hospital to anchor, no.
So even that addresses the institutional issue. How about the individual service providers, doctors, nurses, and everything that goes with that? Do they have any ethical responsibility to continue care for people, even though the institution that was, I guess, the foundation has disappeared?
Well, ethically, groups like the AMA, the American Board of Internal Medicine, and other groups say if you're going to close your practice, you should give your patients every opportunity to get alternative care providers for them. In other words, they have, without going into the details, a moral requirement that you ease people out. Say you're going to retire or you're going to move or whatever. As a doctor, they tell you that you really have to pay attention. You cannot. The worst thing you can do in medical ethics, and this is why your unwords were so on point, Jim, abandon the patient. You can't abandon patients. You know, it's the mortal sin. It's the worst thing you can do to leave somebody abandoned. When a hospital does it, we're shocked and startled. Individual doctors are not supposed to do it. However, combine that with a business approach, a free market approach to healthcare, the two don't sit together because that is businesses close overnight.
Well, you know, the other thing that is disturbing about this North Adams story is it's a tough town, as you said, and a lot of people that live there are depending on government health insurance, Medicare, and Medicaid.
And by the way, they're probably the biggest employer in town.
They are the biggest
yeah,
employer.
Yeah, 500 people work there. It's only
14,000
yep. people in
yeah,
North
that's
Adams.
Right.
It's a small town. But anyway, Medicare and Medicaid, you hear this all the time, do not reimburse health care providers enough for the cost of care they're providing. That's a huge ethical issue, too. You hear this about the government all the time.
So if you have private insurance, we're paying huge costs. If you have no insurance, you're paying enormous amounts. But the government, when it pays, tries to negotiate more, and it really does engage in a kind of price limiting, and they know that doctors aren't going to complain too much because there's enough people out there who have private insurance that they can refuse to see them or not take them in, or similarly at the hospital level by setting rates low in Medicare and Medicaid. They don't get a lot of pushback because doctors just pull out of those programs. The whole thing is a moral mess. You can't start to make benefits available to vulnerable populations like the elderly or the very poor or single moms, and then set rates that basically say you can't get access. And that's why I've been a little unhappy with the Obamacare debate. We're arguing about websites. What we need to be arguing about is reimbursement and access. That's the key for healthcare services. It isn't just do you have insurance. If there's no hospital in North Adams, you know, if you cut yourself, you can bite on your insurance card until they take you 2 hours away until you get some care delivered.
Yeah, I know. They were talking about that in New Hampshire in a story in the Globe a couple of weeks ago where people are going to have to drive through the mountains in a blizzard in February to get their diabetes.
It's going to be a big issue in the Shaheen Brown Senate race, too.
It's going to be huge because you just can't do that. Well, let's move on to this story out of Japan. This is a really upsetting story, and I cannot imagine what this young woman was thinking of, if indeed she did fake this research. A young scientist, rising star in Japan, supposedly she had the third most significant breakthrough in stem cell research ever. Tell us the story of this young woman. Went through Harvard for a while, too.
So this research was done in a institute in Japan. Japan has been heavily, heavily investing in biotech, one of their economic engine drivers, not unlike Massachusetts in some ways, trying to stake its future through investment in subsidizing research that will lead to biomedical, bioengineering cures. And to me, it's sound. However, the pressures that come in a country like Japan to show success are enormous. This young woman said she'd found a simple way to get adult cells to turn into more embryo-like cells. All listeners remember all the fighting that's gone on here about embryonic stem cells and all that. Well, if you had an alternative, boy, would you be in business in terms of regenerative medicine, trying to repair things using embryo-like cells if you could turn adult into embryo-like cells with simple chemical bath. She announced it. She said she'd done it, and it's an utter, complete fraud. She didn't do it. It doesn't work. Nobody could replicate it. So what is she thinking? I think what happened here was people were so hopeful that they'd find a simple solution that they wanted to believe it. I also think what happened was she may have been thinking, I think there's something to this. Someone will figure it out. If I announce that I've done it and then someone else actually announces that they've done it 6 months or a year from now, no one's going to challenge me. What happened that doesn't happen often enough is people tried to replicate quickly.
But isn't that what all... I know nothing about scientific research. It seems to me the first thing one should expect with any sort of major breakthrough is everybody else is going to try to replicate it. Obviously, if she's this wunderkind, this genius, she knew it was going to happen. So how does one explain it? Except, as you said at the beginning, the crushing pressure of being a young genius, is that what it is?
So that's a crushing pressure. And think about this. How many journals publish the replication paper? And the answer is not so many. So you get in there with the first breakthrough. And I might add, just to beat up on the media slightly here, as long as I'm getting prizes before they take
them
away, we all announce the breakthroughs, right? We don't say, hey, wait until it's reconfirmed. Coffee is bad for you, or here's a new way to cure cancer. So we're not waiting for replication. We're all doing the here's the breakthrough. We love breakthroughs. In that environment, I think that can lead you to make some pretty poor decisions. Something else to pay attention to. Where are her mentors? I think what's happening is mentorship is falling away in the pressure to come up with results and the pressure to come up with satisfying the funders. I want to point the finger of blame. This is a young scientist at her bosses, because they should have been on top of this too, saying, hey, where's the data? Let's see this.
Yeah, but it's still, you know, the first, when I read this, the first thing that came to mind, I don't know, I remember the Clifford Irving scam when he had the book on Howard Hughes, and he was calculating, since no one had interviewed Howard Hughes, the recluse, for years, that since Howard Hughes didn't talk to anybody, he was pretty safe, because Howard Hughes would never say, by the way, I never talked to anybody, including Clifford Irving, and of course, he did. But, and that's a risk where you say to yourself, well, if you're really crazy, you take that chance, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have to say, I read this reread it. Does anybody who ever does something like this, particularly at age 30, does she ever recover? Will she ever be credible?
I got a story for you, and I'll make it quick.
Yeah.
This field of stem cells has been rife with fraud. Do you guys remember the Korean, we've made human embryos? Announcement from Korea. It was just 4 years ago.
No. Tell us
about it. Guys announced that they would. No one has been able to clone a human embryo. We've seen dogs and Dolly, the sheep, and blah 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 blah. So these guys in Korea, prominent scientists, announced they've done it, and they publish it in Nature, the big science journal. It's complete fraud. And you're thinking, what is going on here? So again, I think the same Clifford Irving type story. They figured someone would do it. Why not us? We'll just announce it. And when somebody does it, we'll say, yeah, yeah, that's what we did too. But those guys are back at their science.
They are
penalized a little bit. The grants were withdrawn, but I've noticed here they come again. They're back working. So nationalism starts to infect what goes on in science these days. It's not just corporate greed. It's national pride, national government. They don't want to lose good scientists. This woman is not a bad, she's done something probably fatal here in terms of ethics, but her science isn't horrible. She's got other things that are legit. I'll bet you that she comes back. It's a weird world out there where if you've invested in your next generation, you don't want to lose them.
Can I digress for 30 seconds? And these are not days where I know anybody should say anything good about anything that Woody Allen did. However, when you mentioned Dolly, I remember maybe my favorite scene. And Woody, for everybody who has not seen this little vignette thing, everything you wanted to know about sex but were afraid to ask, Gene Wilder, who was a genius, Gene Wilder has a relationship with a sheep. And
he does.
In the movie, and it's quite funny in and of itself, but the sheep ups and leaves him. And so the final scene in this vignette, I don't know if you've ever seen it, Art, is Gene Wilder sitting on a curb, totally drunk, drinking from a bottle of Woolite. I'm sorry. It was one of the funniest scenes.
Let me point out to listeners.
Yes.
That's as far as Jim goes in the sciences, right there.
Actually,
right,
that
right
is true.
Woody Allen. But do you remember, I thought you were going to tell me the other story about Woody Allen cloning his nose.
Oh, that's from, which one is that from? That's right. I forgot about that. Where is that from?
I forget. I don't remember.
That is true. It was huge, right?
Yeah.
Nose,
that's the one that also has the McDonald's sign with the 4 gazillion trillion falling off.
Yeah. This is the way
that it's good for you to eat.
Yeah. So Woody Allen dilemma now. Can we still watch the movies after all this accusations? But anyway, Art Kaplan.
Well, the old ones.
That's my standard too, the old ones.
The old ones. Art Kaplan, I want to ask you, and you are our medical ethicist, about a great piece that you wrote having to do with doctors promoting gun safety. What's your thesis?
This one really, everybody put on their earmuffs. So there's been this debate about approving a Harvard doc, a surgeon general, who has spoken out a number of times about gun safety. Now, admittedly, he wants to limit ammunition and put restrictions on guns, but put that aside. The issue is, should doctors be involved with gun safety? And believe it or not, there's a huge number of folks who are pro-gun and pro-NRA who say no. And I think, let's see, what's the right ethical term for this? That is Meshuggah. That's one. My grandmother would have used that back in Mattapan. She would have said they're all crazy.
Mattapan?
Yep, that's where...
Your grandmother from Mattapan?
Yes.
I did not know that.
We know now.
Local roots.
Oh, yeah. So when I look at the gun issue, forget about banning guns or can you own guns. Let's just talk gun safety. Do you tell your little kid, as the NRA says, if you see a gun, walk away? Shouldn't pediatricians talk about that with kids? If you have a person that you're seeing for primary care and they own a gun, shouldn't you ask them, do you lock it up? I mean, we talk about safe sex, and no one's proposing to ban sex. They're just trying to get you to be safe at it. Why wouldn't guns fit into that category? You got suicides, you got accidents, you got kids killing themselves and they find a gun and shoot themselves or shoot somebody else. And people are trying to say that gun safety should not be part of health care and public health. I think that's just grossly unethical.
Art Kaplan, let me
otherwise, I don't have a view about it.
Well, I'm with you 100% on this, but I wonder if the American Medical Association is a very powerful and very well-respected group. It represents physicians, obviously. If they, as a group, got together, almost began crusading against, guns as a public health issue.
Well, do you know they haven't? Have they?
I don't know.
They've come out and said that they, favor gun safety discussion, but they haven't rallied and really pushed. That's the difference.
Is that possible?
Record. Well, the issue is hugely political. The pro-gun forces are strong. They threaten when you get on the wrong side of them. They hate recasting guns as a safety issue with respect to health because it's a position of vulnerability. There, it points out the downside of the real dangers of guns in terms of, as I said, suicide, accident, misuse of guns. They don't like it. They really will fight tooth and nail over it. And politicians run away from that powerful pro-gun lobby. So I think it's time to put on AMA, other medical groups, put on your big boy pants and let's get out there and at least promote gun safety. We don't have to get into gun ownership, gun rights. All we got to talk about is talk to patients about being safe with guns. You expect your doctor to say you're wearing your seatbelt.
Yeah.
You expect your doctor to say, are you engaged in a healthy lifestyle? I think guns is part of the picture.
The key, though, is they have to wear their big boy pants.
They do.
I mean, that is the critical component of this whole. Hey, Art, congratulations again on the recognition.
Yeah, that's
great
terrific.
To talk to you.
Thank you.
Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics, and he just won the National Science Board's 2014 Public Service Award. Coming up next, we're going to be joined by Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory on the Remy case and a bunch of other news. Brian McGrory up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Today at WGBHnews.org, a tale of two Bostons, the marathon bombings and race. If you missed Adam Riley's piece on the radio, check it out at WGBHnews.org right now.
Big data isn't just for Google anymore.
We've reached a point in human history where we create information in everything that we do.
I'm Kara Miller. That's this week on Innovation Hub, Thursday night at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Northeastern University, where researchers are untangling the complexities of climate change to measure the true cost to the world's cities. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And the Summer Investigative Reporting Workshop for high school students at Boston University, where students learn critical thinking and research skills, how to do in-depth reporting, interviewing, and more. necir.org/summer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Wednesday at about this time. He happens to be the editor of the Boston Globe. Hello, Brian McGrory.
Hello, Jim Browdy. How are you?
Great.
Hey, Brian McGrory. How are you?
Hey, Marjorie. How are you?
Terrific. Terrific. It's a very somber day, though, as you know, in Boston today. Lieutenant Edward Walsh, he's being buried today. His funeral is today. we've all been transfixed by this in the Boston media. But, you know, this is one of the times where newspapers do such a fantastic job covering the lives of these firefighters. My colleague Peter Galsinas had a great interview with Michael Kennedy's mother, Kathy Crosby Bell, over the weekend. And your columnist, Kevin Cullen, had a terrific story today about the request of the widow of Edward Walsh, who's being buried today. Tell people that story, Brian.
Well, it was Kevin did a really terrific column today. Thank you for saying that. It ends up that Ed Walsh's wife had requested that she get the wedding band back that was on her husband's hand. But when they went to look for it, they couldn't find it. It wasn't on his hand. They looked around the fire station. They couldn't find it there. And some of the firefighters got together and realized it must have come off in the fire. And they went, and hour after hour, day after day, they searched through the ash and the wreckage that was left behind in that building until somebody finally found it in something of a eureka moment, maybe the only triumphant moment, actually definitely the only triumphant moment of this past week. And they rushed it to the church last night and returned it to Mrs. Walsh in just a wonderful display of solidarity.
You know, it all started. We had the commissioner and deputy chief Finn in the other day, the day after the fire, and the commissioner mentioned he went with Ed Kelly, who's the statewide president of the union, and Richie Parris, the city union. And Kevin's story starts today when Richie and Ed are saying to Walsh's widow, is there anything you want? And she has to think, and then she finally mentions this wedding. It is such an incredibly beautiful story and beautifully told by Kevin. It really, it's really perfect.
It's a stunning story, and please keep in mind the column that Kevin did last week as well on Friday that we put on the front page of the paper about the decisions that were made at the fire and the torture that some of the firefighters felt as they had to go and tell Mrs. Walsh the awful news and visit with Michael Kennedy's mother to let her know that her son had died. It was really an extraordinary column.
Well, you know, also the thing about his mother, just as for one quick moment, is the fact that you read that she was so worried for so many years when he's in Iraq about what's going to happen to him. He survives Iraq and comes back, and it's a fire that takes her son in his hometown. It's just, it's really.
But you know what was amazing about her is she told Galsinas she knew that this was that he was going to die in some heroic way in a risk taking way, because of course he volunteered to take the hose in from another firefighter because that firefighter had young children. Tragically, Lieutenant Walsh has 3 children, 8, 5, and 3. But Kennedy volunteered to do this, and he was dropping out of airplanes and just living this kind of wild and crazy life. And anyway, she was a wonderful woman. Adopted a bunch of kids, too.
I know that, yeah.
She had a great line in an obituary we had today of Michael Kennedy, in which she said there wasn't a high school in Massachusetts he couldn't get thrown out of.
I hadn't read that. That is great. Oh, that is truly great.
I mean,
great.
A wonderful young man, Michael Kelly, and a wonderful mother as well. Well, let's move on to the whole Jared Remy story, which we talked about with you last week. And actually, Jim Browdy, when we were talking about this with you last week, Brian McGroy, said that after Eric Moskowitz's story about how Jared Remy had escaped basically through the criminal justice system, all those arrests, I think it was 18 or 19 arrests, and never, or except for 81 days, had no time in jail. Jim Browdy said, nothing's going to happen about this. Nothing's going to happen about this. Well, in fact, something has happened, has it not?
Something very important has happened. Yvonne Abraham had a follow-up column last week in which she revealed that Speaker DeLeo has been hard at work on tightening laws and in terms of domestic violence cases. And the speaker then had a press conference yesterday surrounded by a whole lot of colleagues in which she said that it is inexcusable that someone like Jared Remy could assault 5 different girlfriends and slip through the system as he did with this many charges against him. So the House is looking to tighten domestic violence laws. The Senate already did last year So all they have to do once the House votes is to reconcile the two and get the signature of the governor, and we're going to have better laws on the books.
So I'm a great admirer of Bob DeLeo, the Speaker. By the way, Martha Coakley was part of that, too. But this is not the day for me to say, why did it take Jared Remy's behavior for them to act to strengthen laws on domestic violence? It's not the day for that, correct?
It may not be. It's a legitimate question. It's a very legitimate question. But you know, as I know, as Marjorie knows, that it often takes something like this to get meaningful action.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to point out that the one person who's on the record is in serious opposition to these new proposed laws is, of course, Ed Ryan, who is the lawyer for Jared Remy. You may not know that Ed Ryan Jr. is also the lawyer for Jim Browdy over here. When Jim got in an altercation on Morrissey Boulevard with a state trooper because Jim didn't want to be stopped in traffic like everybody else when the Prime Minister of Great Britain was leaving UMass.
He's
Boston.
A fine lawyer, and he's a friend of mine, and everybody's entitled to a defense.
Ed Ryan, he's on the front. I like Ed Ryan, too. He's in the front page Metro section today opposing all these laws. Just want to point that out.
No need to comment on that.
On that topic, I mean, and it's a sore topic, an entire metropolitan area is still appalled that the state police would ever stop Jim Browdy in a situation like that.
Outrageous.
So I think the populace is still rallying behind Jim on those.
Do you know that Marjorie had to be called?
Trumped up charges.
Ed Ryan had to call Marjorie as a hostile witness in my trial.
Well,
this is true. In Dorchester, it's a story for another day. In Dorchester District
why don't you
Court,
tell him
is that true?
Why I had to be called? Because you wanted me to fudge the facts.
Hey, Brian. Last week, I asked you if, when the Moskowitz piece was running, which obviously has an impact, I guess, directly, indirectly, on the other property that your owner owns. John Henry obviously owns the Red Sox. Jared Remy worked there. His father now works for Nesson. I asked you if there was any editorial involvement. Your answer was, well, like in any major story, the publisher sees the story, but no editorial involvement. I think that independence issue was even more dramatically shown. John Henry does an interview with Channel 5 last week in which he says, we welcome Jerry Remy back to the broadcast booth. All of Red Sox Nation is happy he's back. And yet, days later, the editorial page takes the totally contrary position, actually 180 degrees different, saying he should at least sit out until the trial is over and at least sit out for the year. Is the same I know you're not the editorial page editor, but is the same process had there that an editorial and something like that, particularly that has an impact on Henry indirectly, is it run by him? But and that's the end of the story there, too?
Well, let me just correct one quick thing, though, Jim.
Sure.
You said that he saw this Jared Remy story before it ran. That's not true. I never said that.
I thought you did. I'm sorry.
No, I told him, I briefed him on the story, said that it was coming Sunday, and, gave him a quick briefing on what the highlights were. He never asked to see it. He never did. He never saw it. It's a credit to him that he, was interested in what we're doing. He believed it was an important story for us to do. And, basically what you're seeing from the editorial that, Peter Canellis is our editorial page editor, what they ran is that, John Henry has opinions, but he's not at this time looking, at the Globe to advance those opinions. And I think smartly so. I mean, that, may or may not change over time. But right now, the Globe is not his vehicle to push an agenda on the city. He just wants to have a truly great paper that is every bit as independent now as it was a year ago before he owned it.
Well, at least as an outsider, as a consumer, as a reader of your newspaper, it's even more dramatic, not so much in the Ark Moskowitz thing, but in the editorial page thing, because it is not unusual at all for a publisher to make final decisions about what an editorial says. Is that not true?
You're absolutely right. You are 100% right. He would be well within his standing to say, I really want an editorial that says X. But, while John Henry is fascinated by the business model and the impact that a major metropolitan paper like the Globe can have, he has apparently made the decision that he just doesn't want to meddle in its editorial voice or certainly its newsroom.
Page one, great photo on the Boston Globe today. Barack Obama smiling. David Ortiz with sunglasses, which I have to say I don't like. A lot of the Red Sox had sunglasses. They go to the White House. A David Ortiz selfie with a Red Sox jersey, Obama 44. When you heard after this thing was taken, and everybody loved it. I mean, it was just a great moment, I should say. When you heard that this was part of a, I don't know if you call it a Samsung production, a deal that Ortiz has with Samsung, and they're bragging in a press release how they prepared them, how it was the Galaxy S, whatever, that took it. What was your reaction to that?
I'll tell you my exact reaction. I groaned to myself, and I just kind of almost said it out loud. Is nothing clean anymore? Is there nothing in this society that is virtuous? Is everything? Ortiz just signed a contract extension for what? 16 million bucks.
Yeah.
What does he need the business deal from Samsung for? What is that all about? You've got to be kidding me. By the way, I'm on a business deal now. I'm about to push a product with you. We'll get to that in a minute.
Well, if everybody else is doing, there's no reason you should.
I'm on an Apple iPhone right now.
Yeah. What is a beautiful picture, though, I do have to say. But
it's
I had
a great
the same
picture.
Reaction. Oh, wow. This deal with Samsung, it did sort of change things. Well, we have one more question, very important question for you, Brian McGroy. And we want to know whether a kidney stone has ever decided an election. And we're asking that, of course, because Steve Grossman, through the intrepid reporting by David Bernstein, Steve Grossman, who was grimacing during the debate with Mass Equality. I think it was Mass Equality. WGBH thing. Yeah, Peter Katsas was moderating. Anyway, Grossman is grimacing, and Bernstein says, what's wrong? And even though he was up there during the question and answers, doing a good job answering the questions, when he's sitting down. So we found out later he had a kidney stone, passed a kidney stone during the debate. I don't know. This could be the key for Steve Grossman, Brian McGray. I'm not sure, but it's always possible.
Well, I mean, I know there are a lot of people who watch these debates on any topic and think that they are passing a kidney stone because they are so tortuous. But if anybody can get mileage out of this, it's Steve Grossman. He really knows how to take advantage of situations like this. There's no reason for you to remember. A couple of years ago, I'm having lunch with him, and he brings up this issue of on his campaign for state treasurer, he would always have these campaign events at ice cream shops, local ice cream shops, whatever town he was in. And I was dozing off during lunch with him, which is always embarrassing when you're one-on-one.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
And when he ever brought up these ice cream events, I kind of jerked awake and ended up writing a whole column on how he's this ice cream savant. He knows every independent ice cream shop in Massachusetts. I was testing him on it, and he was amazing. But, of course, he couldn't leave that alone. I wrote the column, and he ends up handing out ice cream scoops at the Democratic convention.
Why wouldn't he?
Now he insists on calling me every time he tries a new flavor at a new ice cream place.
Oh, my God.
Trust me, we are going to be hearing about this kidney stone for years.
Well, by the way, he did three fundraising letters apparently on it. The Globe did an editorial basically saying TMI, too much information. But then just to know that Marty Walsh was in here, the mayor was in here, I think Friday was he? Yeah, last Friday. And we said in jest, by the way, did you ever pass a kidney stone? And then he regales us with a 4-minute story about how he passed two kidney stones on the air. So obviously that's the ticket in 2014.
Yeah, I didn't know
that. Whenever I think of pain, though, Jim, I always go back to the plantar fasciitis you had in 2004.
Yeah, actually.
I hope you're feeling better.
Well, you know what? Actually, next time you're on, next Wednesday, we can maybe spend a couple of minutes on that. You know what I'll do in the interim? I will call you on my Samsung Galaxy phone on your iPhone later today, and we'll prepare. Is that okay, Brian?
Thank you, guys.
Good to talk to you,
Brian McGroy. Thank you very much for calling in. Brian McGroy is the editor of the Boston Globe. He joins us every Wednesday. And coming up, WGBH's arts editor, Jared Bowen. He's going to join us for an update on the local art scenes. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
They say that some folks have never seen Ireland for themselves. Well, what are you waiting for? Join me, Brian O'Donovan, this October for an Irish sojourn through the scenic southwest of Ireland, a place so lush and green you'll understand why they call it the Emerald Isle. We're also bringing legendary singer-songwriter Robbie O'Connell along for the ride. But space is limited. Please visit wgbh.org/learningtours for more information.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. you can visit Dover Rugg's new showroom in Natick featuring a squash club or doverrug.com. And Moo.com, where you can print business cards with the option of a different design on every card in a pack. You can say hello with Moo.com. That's Moo.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to talk movies, local theater, and how the infamous Sleepwalker has been faring these days out there. Wellesley is GBH Arts Editor Jared Bowen. Jared's host of the TV show Open Studios, which you can catch Friday nights on Channel 2. Hey there, Jared.
Hi there. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you too, Jared. And I cannot wait to hear your take on this play, The Whale, which I've read so much about. Tell
so
people
well.
The premise and what you thought of it.
Well, it's great. And part of the reason I think it's great is because it's a subject that's certainly not dealt with very often in society. Overweight people, morbid obesity, and it's dealt with on stage here in The Whale. And you find a 600-pound man, Charlie, and he you realize from the beginning when you walk, first of all, let me set the stage for you because the staging here is fantastic. You walk in and it's this massive carpet. You look like you're walking into a living room and it's littered with debris, like an ocean field. Empty food wrappers and pizza boxes and big gulp cups. And the stage is sort of listing, again, evoking the sea and the whale. And he's sitting in this sofa and it's sinking into the ground. And then there's this terrific soundscape, but it's a mix of whale sounds and breathing, his breathing. So you know the environment that you're headed into. And then you find Charlie, who is this man who's in congestive heart failure. He knows that his death is looming, and he's trying to just try to salvage the last vestiges of relationships that he's had with his ex-wife. He's a man who's now gay, and he's lost a partner, and you come to understand how that all has all played into his obesity. So trying to connect with his wife, his daughter, and then he really has just one friend left, who is a nurse that comes by to visit him. But what I was so struck by in this piece is the question of humanity, because he becomes an object here. He's not a person anymore, even though there's real dialogue, real conversation, real circumstances, and even the way he looks at himself. He's disgusted by himself. He detests himself. And that's what was really resonant with me, because you know that happens. I mean, you know that we turn away from certain people in our society for whatever physical ailment, you know, and especially morbid obesity.
Should we the reviews say this John Kuntz, who played him, is brilliant. Should we know of him?
Oh, absolutely. He does a lot of writing around town, and he's been around for years. He started in a lot of productions over at the ART and now all around town.
Is this hard to watch?
It is hard to watch.
I mean, when you told us, I think you told us a couple of weeks ago, or I heard you on Emily, I heard you somewhere talk about the subject matter, and I'm saying, how could they possibly do this in a theater particularly? But it is hard to watch.
Well, and it's good in a it's hard in a good way, because I've seen Johnny Kuntz in so many productions, but he totally loses himself in this character. This premiered in New York. They have the same fat suit,
which is amazing. Tell people about the fat suit.
I mean, he's just basically in sweats, but it's so well developed that you feel like you're looking at an obese man, and they have some prosthetics around his face to give him the wider girth in the face and the neck, and then the way he does move around a couple of times, and it's so labored, and his breathing is so labored that's why you completely forget that you're watching this acclaimed actor. And
what's going to be great about this, because there is such a real prejudice against people who are overweight, and if you're really overweight, and to get that perspective on his. The sadness he feels and the grief and regret he feels about a situation, I think is just what makes this so special.
And what life is like, too, because
yes.
They say that in real time he goes to the bathroom. And rather than giving you a truncated version of his walk to the bathroom, apparently in the play, it's literally how long and laborious the trip from couch to bathroom
is. On a walker.
And you know, the funny thing, Jim, it didn't even dawn on me that we sat there watching him walk for the time it takes until you just said that, because you're so immersed in it. You are absolutely pulled into this world. And that's why you feel so much for him, because, you know, essentially he's eaten his feelings, and society he paints them as the culpable factor, the culpable people here, when we know it's much more than that. It's a disease or other circumstances. And so he's somebody who's been, you know, cast adrift, thus the whale.
You had thought this was great, obviously. I mean, I can tell in your voice you really thought it was terrific.
I did. And the great thing about it, I don't think I saw this on opening night, but I saw it on a subsequent Sunday. And so, as I like to say, the regular people audience. And it was very, very emotional, especially around me. You know, often I can sort of distract myself by taking notes and whatnot, but I found myself very moved, and I was really struck at the difficulty a lot of people were having.
Can I ask an uncomfortable question? Because, like, the
I
play,
have one too.
Were there a significant number of overweight or obese people, a disproportionately large number in the audience, or no?
No, not that I noticed, but I will tell you that I did do it. I had a conversation with Emily on Greater Boston after, when we had a man who was about 600 pounds at one point until he had gastric bypass, and he's somebody who does work in the local theater community, and so I had seen that transition in him, and he talked about how they got it exactly right. Everything that he went through, everything he experienced and was thrust upon him, he saw on stage.
Now, I just want to know, and this is an uncomfortable question too, but my curiosity is getting the best of me here. We know he couldn't get around very well. So how do you get all this food?
This is the worst part, and this is what happens too. It's this friend who comes to visit him, and she, by the way, is played by Georgia Lyman, who
the
is
nurse.
Also fantastic. Yes, his nurse friend, and you come to understand why they have this layered and very deep relationship and why she really is his only friend, but also treats him very, very horribly. It's almost as if she's taking out her anger on what he's done to himself on him, and she allows herself to do that, but she's the one, and it's so tough because there's one scene where she brings him, you know, she's berating him for his condition and being so close to death and not taking care of himself, and then offers him two meatball subs.
Oh, man. You know, by the way, I'm very disappointed in you. Despite that review, I cannot believe you've not said, describe the student who played the estranged daughter. Where does she go to school?
She goes to Emerson College.
Yes, she does. She goes.
Do you know her?
No, I don't. My daughter is there, too, but I was really excited when I read it. It's leaving this weekend, right?
It's leaving this weekend. Race to it, yeah.
Okay, let's move on to this musical, dance and musical spectacular, this Heartbeat of Home. Tell us about that, please.
A sequel? Is that a stage sequel? Is that what this apparently is?
In a way, it's the same team that's presented Riverdance and created Riverdance 20 years ago, which, of course, went on to become this huge international phenomenon, still travels the world. So they've gone back and they've looked at what they had, some of the materials, and Irish step dancing is still very popular, but they've created Heartbeat of Home in taking you to many homes around the world. So you have Irish step dance, and you have the tango and salsa, Latin American dance, you have African dance. This is so well staged. It's playing at the City Wang Theater now, that big, giant space. It is fantastic. I had so much fun the other night because, first of all, these dancers are incredible. They're all lithe and sinewy, and you just marvel at how their legs move so swiftly and in unison. It is just absolutely something to behold. And then the staging is completely lavish. They have these big, giant digital projections that take you all around the world, and you feel like you're either being hoisted above this massive skyscrapers in this great urban city that could be New York, but any city around the world, or sailing over the seas. It's beautifully, beautifully done.
Ooh.
So did you see this with real people, too, or not with real people?
No, I saw this on opening night, but did you know that I had a dance lesson with them?
No.
You didn't?
I didn't see you. You did it on TV?
I did.
So they had a little, you know, publicity thing before the show up, and they invited me, and I went with a few people. I'm laughing because I'm so awful. I have no artistic talent whatsoever, which is why I have to talk about other people's. But I was there with Joyce Gilhawick and a few other personalities, and we had to do this very minimal step dancing, and I was awful. I couldn't.
I've got bad news for you. When you said you were awful, that was an opportunity for Marjorie to interrupt and say, no, I saw it. You were not awful at all.
She did not take the opportunity. You didn't look off. I saw a clip of it because Jessica Heslam from The Herald, she was step dancing too, so I saw the video. You looked fine.
By the way, how do you like that review? You were not awful.
No, you were
really
not awful.
That's the ultimate praise for a performer.
Really hard. By the way, do you get to bring a guest, or do you have to go to all these things alone?
Are you fishing? I will always take you, Marjorie. I will always take you.
No, I wasn't fishing, but it seemed like it would be, you know, this is your job to go see all these openings, but it's kind of lonely to go by yourself.
No, I often take I take people. You know, what I really like to do is I sort of spread the word amongst my little social group that if there's something you really want to see, please let me know and I'll take you because I want to do nothing more than to provide people opportunities that they want to avail themselves of.
Okay, let's go from
stage. I'll hit you up a couple of weeks.
To a screen. Let's play a little sound from a movie that's gotten I think, terrific reviews, but apparently not one here. I was going to call it Cafe Budapest, which is long gone. The Grand Budapest Hotel by, I consider to be a genius, Wes Anderson. Here's Ralph Fiennes as Gustav H.
It's Listen. Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, Ralph Fiennes?
It's Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, here we go.
I heard that you were teased.
Can I tell you, this
you
is really...
incredulous if I didn't say his name
here
is
we do.
Ralph.
For those who don't know, his name is spelled Ralph. We have to give you the backstory here.
I've called him that for instance, he was in The English Patient.
So I ask, like so have I, and I ask our producers how you pronounce his last name, and they say, well, actually, you should know his first name, even though it's spelled Ralph, is Rafe, and I knew that it was a continuation of yesterday's April Fool's that Marjorie started on me, but Chelsea says this is not an April Fool's joke, so let's get it straight. Ralph Fiennes?
It's Ralph Fiennes.
I don't believe you either. Here it is. Here's a little sound.
And so my life began. Junior lobby boy in training under the strict command of Monsieur Gustav H. I began to realize that many of the hotel's most valued and distinguished guests came for him.
I love you.
I love you. She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84.
I've had older.
I became his pupil, and he was to be my counselor and guardian.
You know, before you say something bad, Tilda Swinton, Ralph Fiennes, Willem Dafoe, Ed Norton, Bill Murray, Owen Wilson, and Wes Anderson, how can this not be great?
I know. For some reason, for me, it just didn't come together in the most engaging way. And I will say that, I always recalibrate. I always say this. You can't go to a local show expecting you're going to see something on Broadway. I went to this thinking, okay, I'm not going to see Moonrise Kingdom, which was Wes Anderson's last film, and I thought his best ever. And it made me so excited to see this, but it didn't. You have this great cast. You have this great visual vocabulary that Wes Anderson has because, of course, everything is highly stylized, everything from the costumes to the scenics to actually how he tracks the camera to move along with people. But and essentially, this is a caper. You have Ralph Fiennes.
I love the word caper, by the way. I really do love the word caper, but go ahead.
So even more reason for you to see it. So Ralph Fiennes is this concierge in this hotel in this sort of anonymous time in this anonymous region that's somewhere in Europe that's at some point the victim of war. And he gets sent to jail and must break out and thus his caper ensues. But so you have all these great characters and all this great storytelling, but it doesn't come together for me anyway in a really cohesive way that's really, really engaging. Instead, I felt it just sort of plods along.
How is Swinton? I think I'm a huge Swinton fan.
She was the best part of this. She was so good playing this 85-year-old woman. Yeah. And the problem is she's only in it for about 5 minutes and then she dies. And I can tell you that because it happens at the beginning of the movie, and that's what sets off the caper.
Okay, well, I'm disappointed it's not good either because I've always liked him. He's had a lot of great roles. He was in Schindler's List, and he was in The English Patient, which was rather long, but it was maybe more of a girl movie, but I really liked that. Very romantic.
Well, it's nice to see him in this movie, too, because if they're going to be with Wes Anderson, they're going to be fantastic. And he does. He gets all of these fun performances. Ed Norton, I mean, I've never enjoyed him so much until I started seeing him in the Wes Anderson movies, and he's so funny in this one, too.
You know why the other ones were better? Because that's when he called himself Ralph, Marjorie, in the earlier days. That's
oh,
when
he was in that The End of the Affair with Julianne Moore, too. That was pretty good.
I know, he's always so serious.
Yeah, that was that great Graham Greene novel that was turned into a not-so-great movie, but it was still fun.
Yeah.
Okay, you can't possibly say anything bad about this. Muppets, everybody's been waiting. A clip from, this is the trailer for Muppets Most Wanted. In this scene, an evil criminal mastermind frog named Constantine masquerades as the great Kermit.
The world's greatest criminal has stolen the greatest treasures, escaped the greatest prisons, and he bears a strong resemblance to someone you know.
It's not easy being mean. My name will go down in history as greatest thief of all time.
You mean our names, right?
Of course. My name first, then spacebar, spacebar, spacebar.
Another caper movie.
Okay, Jared Bowen, I hope this is good.
I love this.
Good.
I was raised on the Muppets. They never seem to go wrong. I think this is the seventh sequel now, and they have a whole number about sequels at the beginning of the film. It's hilarious. And I love, it's almost like Wes Anderson, how they pull in these great people like Ricky Gervais, and you have Tina Fey playing Nadia, the keeper of this prison where Kermit the Frog gets sent after he's confused with Constantine, the world's most dangerous frog. It's so funny. You have
the
Ty Burrell.
The most dangerous frog.
And you know what I realized? I don't know who your favorite Muppet character is. I finally realized who mine is, which is Animal. because he has this one scene. He's the only one in this whole movie who knows that Kermit has been replaced by this bad frog. And so he keeps trying to attack Kermit, saying, bad frog, bad frog. Every time I think about it, it makes me smile.
Okay. So this is a definite one, especially for the kiddos. I mean, this is
not just that's the beauty of the Muppet movies,
but
right?
But it's not too scary for the little kids.
No,
sometimes.
Because you have these, it's absolutely not too scary. Okay. But the Muppets are fun because you have the great humor sensibility. Jason Segel took it over a couple years ago, and now you've got Ricky Gervais helping and Tina Fey. So they bring this very distinctive personality that meshes with what we love about Muppet humor.
Okay, I'm glad to know about that. Okay, are we moving on next to, we're going to Divergent. We have a little clip from Divergent. This is this kind of weird movie about this woman that winds up being this outsider in this dystopian society, and here's the clip.
The only way our society can survive is for each of you to claim your rightful place. Today, you will take a test that will help you discover who you truly are. The future belongs to those who know where they belong.
Your results were inconclusive.
This was supposed to tell me what to do. We're supposed to trust the test.
The test didn't work on you. They call it Divergent.
Okay, was that Kate Winslet that was whispering there?
I love Kate Winslet.
So do I.
Be nice. I love Kate Winslet.
No, me too.
There's not enough of her in this movie. This is also a good film. This is the latest sort of tween, there are these series now like Twilight and then The Hunger Games. And this is being really compared to The Hunger Games because you find this, it's after the world, most of the world has been destroyed. Humanity obliterated in some kind of war. So basically the walled off city of Chicago is all that really exists. And people are divided into different factions, the smart group, the kind group, the honest, the protectors, and those who are simple. And basically it's done this way so that there can be order. As long as everybody conforms to their group, then you can have order in society. But then along comes this young woman who must test for which group she belongs in, and she doesn't test for any. She's a divergent. And so
She
upsets the natural order. And you know who's also really good in this is Theo James. He's a British guy, absurdly good-looking, but also absurdly talented. You might remember him if you watched Downton Abbey. He was Mr. Pamuk, who died in Lady Mary's bed.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So he plays, he's alongside her in the Dauntless group, which they're their protectors. And the movie is too long. It's not perfect. It's not as good as The Hunger Games. And I think it's fair to compare them because they're both about societies and how we're dealing with societies and rising above and trying to be solid individuals and crusade for ourselves, which of course are great themes for the young men and especially young women who are going to see these or read these books. But I largely like this.
So it's not quite as good as The Hunger Games, but it's pretty good.
It is.
If you're a Winslet-ophile, but you've seen few of her films, what's the first one you'd suggest people see?
There was that great one where she, Little Children. Remember that? It was actually written by Tom Barada here.
Boston. I read the book. I didn't see the movie.
With Patrick Wilson, who's sort of like the king of the urban mom.
Have you ever seen The Reader also?
She was great.
She's unbelievable.
Have we ever seen, it was so criticized.
In the recent one, the Joyce Maynard movie, but it still looked pretty sexy to me.
I liked it. I thought it
you
was
did?
Good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cesar Chavez, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers. Obviously, everybody remembers Great Boycotts or has read about Great Boycotts. What's the deal with this?
So this is done by Diego Luna, who we know from – he was in Y Tu Mamá También. He wanted to tell this story because he's probably in his early 30s and realized there is a whole generation now, if not more, of people who don't realize this crusading that happened by Cesar Chavez to organize the farm workers in California. And he was largely responsible for the organization that they have today to get fair wages and be treated with humanity out there in the fields. So he – charts this story starting in the early 60s through the organization that when there's finally an agreement between the migrant farm workers and the operators, the vineyard owners. The problem with this, although I'm so thankful that he's told this story because even I wasn't that familiar with it, is that it's more of a pastiche across 8 years. So all of a sudden you see him organizing with his wife and you have a hint of the family that may be sacrificed because he's off trying to do what he's doing and getting arrested and his wife is doing the same. And then suddenly Bobby Kennedy is coming to California to testify about why they should be treated better, and then suddenly you're seeing Ronald Reagan intervene as governor, and it's not a cohesive narrative, which is a problem because you have nothing to really sink your teeth into about, you know, investing in this crusade that he has.
Is it English? It's an English language
film. It's an English language film, yep.
Yeah, I mean, a great figure, actually, in workers' history in this country. So even if the movie's imperfect, I would urge people to go. You know, Jared, let's step back for a second. We've talked a number of times in the air with you about the controversial Sleepwalker out there at Wellesley. Apparently, you revisited it, literally and figuratively, about a month or, well, how, I don't know how
just
recently.
A couple of days ago.
Oh,
actually,
really?
Because, you know, as I had kept talking about, the Sleepwalker was part of a larger exhibition. This wasn't just about putting this person, this statue out on campus to provoke the young women there who were ultimately upset. This was deliberately designed to be part of the piece. In fact, he was staged so that you would see him from the final gallery of the exhibition inside, and so you could get a sense of his vulnerability, because the artist Tony Mattelli said, this is only a sculpture of sleep and vulnerability and a man who's cast off out there in the cold in his underwear. And so I went back to see the show. The show is really fantastic. At the Davis Museum, he really upends all our notions of how things should be. You go inside the museum, you see an upside down bouquet that's also a sculpture. These ropes that just stand up on their own. You see Josh, the sculpture Josh, who's just hovering.
I've seen photographs.
Cargo
of that,
pants. Yeah, I mean, it's so staggering. But I have to tell you, the most emotional thing for me, because I just put the piece together this week for Open Studio, is the other piece that's outside is this piece called Stray Dog. And just like the Sleepwalker, it looks like a real dog, and he has a harness, as if, you know, a blind person would be walking him, but the person's not there. So you just see this dog in the harness by himself or herself up against the shadows of this building.
Oh.
So it breaks your heart that there is this tone of vulnerability. Here's this poor dog all alone now, cast against the shadows. Across the campus is Sleepwalker, still left out there. And especially now that we have a history of him, we feel like we're invested in him. He's still out there. Nobody's rescued him. His eyes are still closed. He's still only in his underwear. I think the piece only becomes even more poignant over time.
How long is the exhibit there, Robert?
It's up through July.
Hey, Jared, before you go, since I know Marjorie's going to criticize me in the next segment, let's find out a little bit about you for just 60 seconds here. We're going to talk about a couple of apps that allow people to do one of two, I think, very important things. Either avoid people, or if you're with people, get away from people. We'll describe how the apps work in a couple of minutes. Is this something you would find useful? You're out almost every single night. You're in places where there are
town.
Hundreds and hundreds of people, many
fighting
of whom
off
know
his friends
who
want
you are.
Free tickets.
Would this be something that you would download and use, or would you or do you not need that kind of thing?
I would find that helpful.
Oh, see there. Okay, fine. There are two of us. Fine. I mean, that obviously.
There's another one.
He's being understated. It's quite obvious. I would find that helpful.
Okay.
He said.
We won't.
I
tell
get so
anyone.
Angry with my friends who say, "Did you not see that I needed rescuing? I mean, do I have to send up smoke signals at this point?"
Well, we have a solution. We have
we
a
do.
Solution.
A couple of
the
Jared,
smoke
thanks,
signals
as
coming
always.
Up. Jared Bowen, thank you for being here, as always. Jared Bowen is WGBH's arts editor and the host of Open Studio, a fantastic show which you can catch on Channel 2 every Friday night at 8:30. Thanks again, Jared.
See you, Jared.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to ask you about the anti-social network that Jim and Jared were just talking about. Would you use an app to escape an awkward encounter? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Turns out many of the same companies like Walmart who benefit from billions of dollars in food stamp revenue also have hundreds of thousands of employees on food stamps.
They told me how much I'd be making, and I was like, it's like being punched. And I knew that I would still need the services.
I'm David Gura. Part two of our series, The Secret Life of Food Stamps, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, serving New England since 1980, now offering moving and storage services coast to coast, with offices in major cities across the country. More info at gentlegiant.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Smartphones and apps are, what, 90% about social networking, staying connected, LinkedIn, on the grid. But now, in a paradoxical twist, there are a handful of apps designed to keep you from socializing. There is Cloak, C-L-O-A-K, which is designed to let you go incognito. Here's the idea. You log in the app using either Foursquare or Instagram. You are then shown where all of your friends are. And this allows you to avoid real-world contact with people you'd just rather not see. Then there is Tickle. I love this. If you find yourself in an awkward encounter with somebody you can't get away from, you didn't use Cloak, for example, all you do is scratch or tickle your phone. You know what happens, Marjorie?
It calls you
and gets you out of the bind. So we want to know at 877-301-8970, is this the end of civilization, as Marjorie apparently thinks? Are these apps allowing us to be social cowards? Or, as somebody who Marjorie admires quite a bit, Jared Bowen just said, are they, quote, useful? 877-301-8970. I have to say, I think it's spectacular. Both are spectacular. They're needed. They are long overdue. And they solve a problem that most people don't know how to solve.
Well, you know how to solve it, Jim. You're way ahead of the game on this. You know, if you don't mind my saying that what you do on many occasions, you're going out for a drink or you're going out for dinner with someone, which is really horrific to think about. And you say to me, Marjorie, you're going to call me at 7:30 and say there's an emergency situation.
I have a human app. You're my human app.
That's right. I mean, it seems a little bit much. And you've also employed, I think, a rather brilliant technique that apparently, may I say who told you about this?
Yeah, you could.
United States Senator John Kerry.
Well, let me tell you the story of that.
Yeah, yeah. It's so you don't look at anybody. You avoid eye contact. That's right. You don't look at anybody so they can't look at you and say, hi, Jim.
Here's what he said to me. Shortly after he lost the presidential election, I am flying through Denver to somewhere, and I can't remember where. And I'm in Denver Airport, and I see in the distance John Kerry.
Jim and John are on a first-name basis.
It's not the case at all.
Jim and John go out for cocktails.
He is not even
Lower
close.
Beacon Hill.
He just lost the presidential election. What was the name of his body man? The guy with him all the time was like 6'7". What's the name of the guy?
He's fairly legendary.
I can't think of it either. In any case, the two of them are walking through, so I walk over and I say hello. Mm-hmm. And I say, how do you get through an airport without going crazy? I mean, I'm describing the situation.
Hold on. I would like to point out that John Kerry ran for president.
He did.
He's recognizable in most places.
I wasn't
all
comparing myself to him.
I was
asking him about how he dealt with the fact that he had been on the front page of every newspaper, the lead of every newscast for months. He was a Democratic nominee for president.
How does Jim swat back the fans
to
Commonwealth Avenue?
And you know what he said? Marvin Nicholson. Chelsea is the name of the body man, the man who essentially attended to presidential candidate Kerry, and he was still with him. And he said to me, and by the way, he said it with a smile on his face. He's not nearly as antisocial at all. I shouldn't give him that as I am. He said, never make eye contact. And he said it with a smile, and he was laughing. Meaning, if you walk through a crowded area and you don't make eye contact, 99% of people who are probably going to say hello to you don't. But
those
who have not mastered the technique of now Secretary of State Kerry, there is Tickle, where if you are in a situation with someone, you want to get out and you haven't told Marjorie Egan to call you, you scratch your phone. You scratch your phone and it calls you on the spot. And you know what you can also do? You can pre-program it with this app, Marjorie, so that the name and face of a particular person who'd be most believable to call you at that time calls you on the phone, or this Cloak thing,
so all you
which
fans
tells you where all your friends
of
are.
Jim Browdy, who are listening to this right now.
Don't
just
do this.
Know that
I wasn't about
if you
that.
See him as a man about town, he will not look at
not,
you.
Not, I will. I'll be happy to meet you. I will. I may tickle my phone.
Thousands of people want to know.
I didn't make that was not my point. 877-301-8970. Do you find these apps to be appalling, as Marjorie does, or do you find them to be, as Jared Bowen, I'll hide behind Jared here, to be useful? And by the way, this is not just about people who you think have large egos, Marjorie. The reality is everybody listening to
everybody
listening to this has encountered a situation. Uh-huh. Another parent from your kids. You tell me. Excuse me. I'm going to get this point out. Marjorie, I admit I'm the master of the short conversation and I move on. Marjorie, if you stop Marjorie on the street, I'll give you a hint. If you see Marjorie, you want to talk to her and you're saying, well, you know, Marjorie's a columnist. She's on the radio. You could talk to Marjorie till next Tuesday, and she will not go away. If there's anybody on the planet who could use these apps,
yeah,
it is you.
Well, here's where they do come in useful. I mean, say you are recently divorced and you just don't want to run into your ex-husband or ex-wife. I mean, that's when it would be perfect. Or you want to keep away. Say you have a dog and your dog has been like attacked by the dog next door, and you've had
a little
fisticuffs practically with the neighbor over this. Then you make sure you're not taking your dog out at the same time as the neighbor's taking the dog out, so you don't have another kind of fisticuff situation. That's where I could see it would be really useful. If they're just, or people you just got into a fight with, you know, and you don't, especially if they live in your neighborhood or they work near you or something, you just
or
don't want to run into them.
Or a talkative parent at your kid's school
That's
who
true.
Never shuts
there are
up.
Some people, it's
By the
true.
Way, we mentioned Cloak, which is we use it through Foursquare Instagram. It sends you a notification if a person comes within a block or two of you. But there's also this thing called Split, which is even better. Not only does it tell you where somebody is who's in your ambit, in your world, it sends an alert not only when they're nearby, Marjorie, mm-hmm. but it shows you a route with a map
to avoid
so you
them.
Can avoid them.
Yes.
So basically, if you're in a part of town or wherever with which you're not familiar, it
no.
says Jane Doe is here, and this is the way you avoid Jane or John mm-hmm. Doe. I don't think there's anything wrong with these things. And the reality is the vast majority of us, you being the most extreme case, mm-hmm. It's very uncomfortable to end a conversation with some people. And the best and easiest way, maybe it's cowardly, is to either avoid them, or if you can't avoid them, then allow someone in quotes.
Okay.
Sort of like, what was the name of the football player who had the fictitional girlfriend? What was his name?
Oh,
Monte
I don't
know.
Teo he made up the girlfriend. That was
essentially,
awful.
But that's essentially what the phone call's like.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 871-301-8970, or bpr@wgbh.org. If you want to email or call us about whether you, too, would be enamored of this idea, being able to avoid the ex, being able to avoid some neighbor you don't like, being able to avoid someone you just had an argument with.
Excuse me, being able to, no, you may love this person, but you don't want to get involved in a 45-minute conversation. So you say,
well, you
give
know,
me a call
yeah,
after 5,
you
tickle
also
your
say,
phone.
I have to go. I have something
when
to
have you
do.
Done that, Marjorie?
It's hard for me.
Okay.
It's hard for me.
Marjorie
but I'm
is almost,
on it.
When Marjorie is stopped in the halls at GBH by a colleague,
that's right, I'll be there
is
for
it
hours.
Fair to say that you occasionally have almost missed the show because you don't
I'm
know how
better.
To say to someone?
I'm getting better. We're on the air in 2 minutes. I have used that excuse.
Luke, you're on the road. You're first on this topic here on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Luke.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
All right, great. I'm glad I waited. I'm glad I had to wait a couple of minutes to make my statement because I really like what you just said to Marjorie. You know what? Use your mind and tell somebody that you don't have time to talk to you. Talk to you later. What, you know? I'm sorry I don't have a more clever way to put this, but I think people just have to use their brains. Now, what's going to happen is just being human in these situations. I think we're all just getting kind of lazy about it.
Luke, I'd love to continue this. I just got a phone call. I can't. Now, so, Luke, do you ever find yourself unable to extricate yourself as Marjorie does or no? I mean, by the way, how do you do it? I mean, it's one thing if you have a deadline. You say, I got to be on the air in 2 minutes. If you have nothing to do but just don't want to talk to the person anymore, what do you say? I'm sorry, I've had enough of you?
No, you know, I'm not that good at it. But absolutely, and here's the thing, is that's like practice in me just being a human being. And I know it every time it's going on is that I have to practice doing that, or that it just, you know, puts me on the spot, but it kind of feels good to have that kind of practice. So what's going to happen with these things is that it's sort of like they're just playing in devices that we all have. You know, you want to avoid people. The next thing you're just going to want to avoid your wife. Forget your ex-wife.
Can I tell you, Luke, you're a grown-up, if there ever was one. This is not really. This is an adult human being who has a very healthy attitude. Luke, thank you
I
for
can
the
see,
call.
Though, if you're going out for an expensive dinner, like in a small restaurant, mm-hmm. you wouldn't want to run into your ex-spouse in there if you were with your new love interest or something like that. It would ruin the whole dinner.
Well, what do you do? Excuse me. If you're eating dinner, the app's not going to help you. What are you going to say in the middle of the appetizer? Bring the check?
Well, can't you kind of scope out the restaurant with one of these things? Make sure
oh, you mean
not
before
there?
You go there?
Yes, before you go could. In. Kind of cruise around the parking lot or maybe surreptitiously sneak around the outside of the perimeter of the restaurant. Make sure there's no one in there you don't want to see.
Marjorie is finding this app much more appealing as the
conversation
goes on. Well,
you think of people you've run
on.
Into, you know, like certainly like a physician or something like that you really don't want to see out having
no,
dinner,
there's
you know
nothing like when you're out with a friend and your shrink sits down at the next table. I'll tell you, it's never happened to me, but in the abstract, it's something that I would find very uncomfortable.
That's particularly been difficult for you because there's been so many of them.
There have been a few. There have been a few.
Hundreds.
Ted, you're in Boston. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Ted. Hi.
Hi. Thanks a lot. Yeah, I thought I was in the minority until I heard from Luke, but I'm sort of in agreement with him. I think I'll expand on what he said. It seems like technology and all these apps are, you know, we're kind of depending on them to take responsibility for our lives. We need to take responsibility. You know, if we're not comfortable in a situation, we've got to deal with it. And if we can't just, like, spin the app and let it fly us out of the situation, that's kind of, I think you alluded to it earlier, cowardly. It's a little cowardly.
Well, it is cowardly. So, Ted, Marjorie is one of the most decent people I have ever met.
I wouldn't go that far.
No, you are. A little guidance as to how she can embrace a non-app approach to ending a conversation politely. She's here for to be taught. Go ahead.
Right. No, I'm sure she's very tactful. I mean, she's wonderful on the radio. She has possibly two extremes, like all of us. You know, we want to just bolt and be kind of rude at times, but we've got to overcome that sort of darker tendency and figure out how to do it kindly.
A darker tendency. You are absolutely correct.
Another grown-up. Thank you for the call. So why can't you do it, Marjorie?
I don't know why I can't do it. Listen to Art. He just emailed.
He's
thanking you for giving information about John Kerry because he said 15 years or so ago he was working in Washington, flying back and forth, and he saw John Kerry in the airport numerous times and noted that he seemed to be deaf since he never acknowledged Art when he tried to
get his attention. Is that really what the guy's writing?
Talk to him
That's
as
great.
He walked past. You know, Senator Kerry. Hello, Senator Kerry. Nice to see you, Senator Kennedy.
Thought
he was. What did I say?
Kennedy.
Kerry. I thought he was just obtuse or deaf, but now he understands that avoiding Art seemed to have been intentional. Thank
Can
you,
I tell
Jim.
You, I want to be careful because I'm implicating John Kerry in something that apparently a lot of people don't like. When I was talking to Kerry in this airport, he was saying hello to zillions of people. So, I mean, he was saying this half in jest, mm-hmm. and maybe when he was busy or going to a major meeting or something, but he was very warm and very open and very kind to people who wanted to talk to him, particularly since he had just lost the presidential election and about close to 50% of the people in the country had voted for the guy.
You know, Caitlin's got a good one. She said she definitely used this app to avoid being hit on or stuck in awkward conversations. It's not always as easy to get away as one might think. She said to men, no, thank you. I'm not interested. I'm married. Only to be met with a, I don't mind.
Diane, you're in Boston. We're talking about apps that allow you either to avoid or get out of uncomfortable personal situations. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. Thank you for the call.
Well, Jim, I met you one time at an event,
yeah.
and you were much more talkative than I would have expected you to be after this conversation.
Well, you know why? Because Marjorie was supposed to call me, and she didn't.
He didn't avoid eye contact quickly enough. That's what's going
so
on.
So which side? That was a rare moment, Diane. Side are you on? Are you on the I need an app or a human being should be able to deal with these situations themselves?
Well, I teach networking, and I'm on both sides of it.
Oh, okay.
I think a couple different things. Is one, for people who this is a problem, use the app until it's not. And then learn how to have some lines. In order for me to get over my fear of being a public speaker, I took acting classes, and then I took stand-up comedy.
Did you really?
I did, yeah. And what I learned in that was you need lines. You need lines. And Margie has her lines. I have to get to the show.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, but Diane, the show is 12 to 2.
It only works once a day.
Right, when someone stops her at 3 o'clock at Whole Foods, what does she do then? I have to get to tomorrow's show?
You know what? She can say then at that point, I would love to talk to you. I have a family member who's waiting for me at home for dinner.
That's a good one.
Another time.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I like that very much.
Do you, Diane, do you literally have a stock list of lines that you use based on the circumstance if you want to get out of an uncomfortable or even not,
Absolutely.
Even if it's comfortable, but you do?
Absolutely. If I'm on a plane and someone starts talking to me, I pull out knitting needles so at least I can knit and talk.
You know, that
That's
is
great,
a great
actually.
One. That is a great one, Diane, when you're all excited because you got your book with you. If you got your iPads, you can read the book on a plane, and someone wants to talk from Boston to San Francisco. That is a tough one. But needing, I don't knit, so, I mean, what
so
would
what?
You say in that situation? I want to read
I
got to
learn
book.
How to knit.
I don't want to talk to you. I want reading.
I knit one thing. It's the same scarf over and over.
Diane, okay. You really have this zeroed in. Diane, thanks for a great call. We appreciate it.
Now, I don't know the answer to this, but maybe you do, Jim. Barbara is emailing in and wants to know if there is a flip side to the app that allows for stalking.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
She wants to be able to know where people are, so you can chase them around.
Well,
you know what I mean?
You could use that first app, that cloak thing, which allows you to identify where people are and avoid them. You could obviously use it to bump in. By the way,
so if you have a love interest, you could just suddenly pop up where they are and see what happens.
Erin, you're in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Erin.
Hi. Oh, wow. I'm so excited to be on this show.
We're thrilled to have you. Thanks.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. So I have advice for you, Marjorie. This is a little harder for guys, but as someone else who is very friendly and outgoing and interested in others, I've kind of perfected, at least when I'm walking around the neighborhood, the chat and go, I like to call it.
So, that's good.
How's it work?
Give me the details.
You don't stop moving. So if you're at the grocery store or you're walking with your husband and a friendly neighbor wants to say hello, you slow down, but you don't stop.
I love that.
And you say, hi, how's the weather? How are the kids? Oh, have a great night. Talk to you later. And you just keep going.
What do you call it again, Erin?
The chat and go.
Chat and go. I think that's terrific. Could you do that, Marjorie? I mean, when you are, it's a lot harder to continue an encounter if the person with whom you're speaking is moving. I think it's
a great
point.
You know, that is a great point. You are very good at this, the drop by. Like, there'll be an event that you need to go to or a party you need to go. You do the drop by where you show up, like, for about 10 minutes, and then I look around and you're gone.
I will tell you, Erin, that was a great call. Thank you. I'll tell you a quick story before we get back to the phones at 877-301-8970. I'm not a huge party fan. And a couple of years ago at a place I worked, I won't say which one it was, there was a Christmas party. And I came in, and as I walk in the door, one of the anchors, who you know very well, first words he says, this is a true story, says to me, this is the annual Christmas party, looks at his watch and says, I'd say 8 minutes. And I said to him, I'm not going to say his name, because I said, what are you talking about? He says, I am guessing you'll be in here, talk to the bosses, and be out of here in 8 minutes.
That's right.
And you know what?
He was right.
He was right. No, I mean, it's some people, they know people. Now, this next caller is somebody we've been talking to on the radio for years. We've actually talked about the opposite. We have talked about actually meeting for years and years.
We
but
never
it has
have.
Not happened. Sean from Dedham, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Sean.
Hey, guys. Marjorie, when I want to end a conversation, I start to talk about a guy named Jim Browdy and the Nesson Show. The end is quick and painless. Believe me, it works like a charm. It's awesome.
God, I'll have to think about that.
We don't call it Nesson, by the way. We call it NECN, but that's okay, Sean.
You switched businesses again, Jim.
Yes, I did.
Marjorie, if I was in a conversation with you, Marjorie, I would want to go on and on forever. I would not want to leave your side. You look
beautiful.
Hey, but
Sean, considering what you do for a living,
you
encounter zillions of people. What's your trick? I'm serious.
Obviously, I have to keep working, so I can't stop and talk forever. So I do the talk as I work, and when they see that I'm working, they usually will walk away, and you know, I'll try to talk to them, but I still have to get something done eventually. But they usually will understand that I'm working and they'll walk away. But now sometimes you want to continue the conversation, so you stop working. You know, if someone looks like Marjorie, I'll talk. I can work another day.
I think the key, Sean, for me, I have a new idea talking to you. I should get brown shorts and a brown shirt. Do you think that'll help?
No, well, not your way.
Sean, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much, Sean. Liz emails and says that she uses a great line, well, I'll let you go. But I got to tell you, that has not worked for me.
No, when you do that, I've had people do that to me. I'll let you go means the implication is I'm doing you a favor, but you know what the speaker is saying is I've had it. And so I don't find that to be an appealing farewell line at all.
But she says it's worked for her. It hasn't worked for me because I have certain people that keep talking and talking and talking. And say, I got to go to bed now.
Try this chat and go thing. This woman called about a minute ago. We only have about 30 seconds, but Gina in Northborough, if you can squeeze it in, go right ahead.
Hi, Gina.
Hi. This has turned into a conversation on how to avoid people in real life, it seems like, or politely tell them to go away. But I had a funny story. It's a little embarrassing and reveals my true identity as a Yankees fan. But I met Derek Jeter once, and I basically just attacked him and really wanted to shake his hand. And I think what he did was so gracious. He just sort of looked me in the eye and took my hand and said, "It's really nice to meet you." And I think that's really just what people want, is to know that they, like,
They really wanted if it's Derek Jeter, Gina.
Yeah.
Gina, I'm sorry to cut you off. We got to go, but thank you for the call.
Yeah, Derek Jeter, Jim Browdy. It's not that much of a leap, you know what I'm saying? Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we have a conversation with Charlie Sennett on Global Headlines. Do not miss that. Counselor Tito Jackson will also be here with an extraordinary story about his birth. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy, and one of the callers we didn't go says, not surprised that Jim would like those apps. Thank you very much. See you tomorrow.
Bye.